Shock the System. Welcome to Dank Discussions with me, Calican CEO Maynard Breslow. In each episode, you'll learn from the trailblazers, leaders, entrepreneurs, and influencers in the ever-moving, ever-growing cannabis industry. Hey there, everybody. Welcome to Dank Discussions. Today, we're joined by Madison Margolin. Madison is a journalist. She's been featured in Rolling Stone, Vice, Playboy, amongst others. And she's even had an article titled, "Was Moses Tripping When He Saw the Burning Bush?" So that's going to be exciting. But now she's the editor, managing editor, and the co-founder of Double Blind Magazine. Thanks for joining me today, Madison.
Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited. You know, today we're going to be talking about a lot of cool things, talking about cannabis and spirituality, and specifically cannabis and Judaism, talking about psychedelics and, you know, kind of the intersection of cannabis and psychedelics and psychedelic renaissance that's going on right now. You know, I think great resource for that, obviously, with Double Blind Magazine. You know, usually when I start off, I ask people, you know, where they're based out of today. Which we'll get into that as well. But, you know, I had something that was a little more interesting that was, you know, usually I ask people, you know, how long you've been in the industry. And, you know, you get answers like, oh, you know, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, maybe they've been around for a long time, you know, 20 years. Some people had a couple people on here for 40 years. But you had, you said my whole life, right? So that was the first time for me hearing that, you know? So talk to me about that, you know, talking about.
Yeah. So I mean, this is really my world. I don't know how else to put it. Like I grew up in this. And what I mean by that is my parents are both pot smoking Jewish hippies. But my mom is kind of like your very stereotypical, like neurotic Jewish mother from Queens, but she does have like a past life in which she did a lot of acid in college. And now she's kind of like, rekindling her relationship with psychedelics these days. And my dad, he's a criminal defense attorney specializing in marijuana cases. So like my whole life, he was basically defending people who got busted for weed, whether they were growing or dealing or whatever. One of his clients was Timothy Leary, who was in prison for a cannabis bust and tried to escape from prison. And it was this whole matzav, and he, Ram Dass, who was a friend of my dad's, backtrack a little bit for the audience who may or may not know the history here. Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert were at Harvard studying psychedelics, doing sort of different types of experimentations. It went a little too far. They got expelled. Timothy Leary sort of became this, the image of, you know, the cheerleader of LSD,
the figure of the whole movement.
Yeah. And Richard Alpert went to India, met a guru named Maharaji, and kind of went on this more spiritual path. I guess Timothy Leary had his own spiritual path, but essentially Richard Alpert adopted the name Ram Dass, which was given to him by the guru. And my dad, has the same guru, essentially. So he met Ram Dass in India, and they're part of the same community. And so when Leary was in prison and they needed help, he came to my dad and said, hey, can you do us a favor here? So that's sort of the context of like how I grew up, sort of like with the Ram Dass community and the cannabis community and, you know, basically like the drug war and drug policy reform specifically were like huge topics of conversation, you could say, as a family value to end prohibition. My dad ended up running for governor when I was in seventh grade in the California recall election against Schwarzenegger on the platform to legalize marijuana. And he had this radio jingle by the Cottonmouth Kings, which are a SoCal punk band. 1-800-420 laws, Bruce Margolin's down for the cause. And I was totally harassed by the DARE officers at school and really embarrassed about it. And so anyways, I tried to like push this part of my identity like away. Like I was a straight A student. My parents were freaks, like just let me be, you know? And I came around to it realizing that like, this is you know, these are values and like how devastating the drug war is and how unjust it is. And basically like all drug prohibition is a way to sort of like keep certain people down and like make it impossible for people to, you know, get the medicine that they need or to have opportunities. And it's just a way of like kind of enacting like white supremacy. And so, yeah, I got really passionate about actually wanting to write about these things. But I did this long-winded, I fell into this accidentally. I wrote a story when I was in journalism school about New York's medical marijuana program, pitched that story to the Village Voice. They gave me a job writing about the rollout of the program in New York, which I didn't know anything about being from California. And then after my job at the Voice, I was like, oh, I guess I write about weed now. But I'm also like passionate about psychedelics and Judaism, and I made it my thing, and here we are. So long-winded, but there you go.
No, not long-winded. I love it. You know, there's so much to take in there. I mean, first of all, I didn't know that story about Ram Dass and your dad and kind of that connection. I knew that you were close with him, just you know, just from just seeing, you know, when he passed, you know, shed his physical form, I guess, so to speak, and you know, seeing the pictures and everything. But other than that, you know, I didn't realize how far back the connection went. And everything like that. I think you mentioned it, but for those who don't know, your Madison's father is Bruce Margolin, another legend, obviously, in you know, advocacy, reform, everything like that, obviously for decades, as you mentioned. But yeah, you know, one of the things there you're talking about was that, you know, as a kid, right, or as not so much a kid in seventh grade, and it's so funny, I remember those that election as well. You know, that recall election. But, you know, as a young person, young adult, you know, teenager, having these parents that you're like, oh my gosh, they're crazy, they're hippie, right? Like, leave me alone, I just wanna live my life, right? And how that affected you, right? For me, it was like the opposite, right? Like my parents are like, don't smoke weed, don't do this, don't do that, you know? So for me, that was my culture, right? From like 15 years old and everything like that. And you know, then I come to find out, okay, my dad does have a history, you know, all this fun stuff as well. And, you know, but, you know, talk to me about that transition a little bit. You mentioned that you just kind of fell into it. Like, when was it really that you kind of, you know, came around a little bit more and you're like, okay, you know, this is something that I want to embrace. You know, it must have been before, obviously, you started writing about it.
Yeah, it was when I was 16, ended up, like, my first little boyfriend was the son of somebody who my dad has known since the 70s. So it was the son of someone in the Ram Dass community. Mm. And he smoked weed. And, like, you know, I kind of reconnected with him at a kirtan, which is a Hindu chanting event. Mm. And I was like, oh, okay, so, like, there's this, like, cute guy here who is not totally embarrassed by his parents. Like, maybe my parents aren't so bad. Like, they schlepped me to this kirtan and now I like met this cute guy. Or I actually had known him my entire life, but I reconnected with him. That was just like a stupid little summer thing when I was in high school. But it kind of got me to like appreciate where I was coming from and to see that like it wasn't just like my parents who were like this freak show, but like there were people who grew up in this also who kind of came to terms with where they were coming from and like their own sort of like familial chaos, but also reconciling that with the value of Maharaji and Ram Dass's teachings. So I ended up at Berkeley for undergrad and kind of wanted to just do like the full experience and like realized that like a lot of the things that I was trying to push down and rebelling against my parents as being this like really just good student, like quiet kid, ended up getting me into Berkeley where I like had them like a massively wild time doing a lot of mushrooms and things like that. And I ended up writing my very first research paper my freshman year on the psychedelic experience. I hadn't even tripped. I'd never done any psychedelic and I read every book I could possibly read and did all my research and wrote about it. And then I was like, all right, I am ready to do this. And I had an amazing experience with one of our mutual friends. And, you know, that was now 10 years ago more than 10 years ago today. And it changed my life. And I just was like, all right, I'm like passionate about this. You know, I think it also kind of following what I've been called to in the psychedelic space has brought me back to Judaism a little bit too, though, in that I, you know, I've always like, you know, my dad and all his friends are these like Jewish guys who are like singing chants in like Sanskrit. And I'm like, oh, you couldn't understand Hebrew, but now we're going to like sing in Sanskrit. Like, you know, what's up. And I was like, why not? Like what? There has to be something in Judaism that is like parallel or core, you know, there has to be like Judaism is hip too, right? Like you don't have to do the Indian thing or the Hindu thing. Not that that doesn't have its own value, but I was like, let's start with where our own roots are first. And so that really allowed me to like investigate Judaism in a different way and like see how it relates to Hinduism and it relates to psychedelic spirituality and cannabis spirituality and, you know, just to kind of look at it differently. And I think that's something the boomer generation kind of didn't really have available, being sort of post-war, wanting to assimilate, having sort of all this like very fresh Holocaust trauma.
Oh yeah. And I mean, and I love that. And, you know, in terms of, I think that's such a benefit. There's so much value to that, you know, kind of being introduced. Cause I mean, I was kind of raised in ashrams, not, you know, the Ram Dass community, but you know, like Baba Muktananda, Siddha Yoga and doing these kind of things. And, you know, so kind of exposed to spirituality as a young age like you, you know, and kind of coming back to Judaism at a later age, I think is such a benefit, right? Because we come with it with, first and foremost, with that experience of spirituality. But for anybody who maybe didn't have that kind of background, being able to look at it from a mature point of view, instead of, you know, I think a lot of it, you know, you mentioned obviously the trauma and the boomer generation, but it's still a problem, right? We still see, you know, the amount of assimilation and obviously people automatically, they gravitate, you know, and Jews are seeking for that spirituality somewhere, right? And like you said, it's like right here in our backyard. We don't give it a chance all of the times, right? But we see it, you know, we see it now as well. So, I mean, you know, is there something that inherently with Judaism you think is kind of pushes people away in that regard? Or people just don't understand that there is that deep level spirituality and kind of people just look at it as rote, you know, routine, ritual, whatever else it is? Or is there something else that you think kind of pushes people or, you know, the people more gravitate towards Eastern religions or other things?
Wait, so the question is, why do people gravitate toward Eastern?
Yeah, you see it. It's not uncommon, right? So, I mean, what is, you know, as somebody who's seen both sides, you know, why is it that people are so kind of, they don't even give a chance, right? Judaism, like, ah, come on, man, you know, gefilte fish and challah and whatever else, you know, like, okay, cool, you know, yeah, I'm going to show up on Yom Kippur and fast and that's about it, you know, and.
I mean, I think there's a problem with Jewish education, specifically in America. It's just gotten really stale. And, you know, like, I would say that Judaism, to an extent, is an expression of altered states. Like, you know, there was just this archaeological dig where they confirmed that cannabis was part of the ritual and traditions, like in the, you know, old temple. There was a tradition that the high priest would, on Yom Kippur, hotbox himself in a room in the temple with, like, the incense that included cannabis and acacia wood, which has DMT in it. And other sorts of, and other ingredients that would, there's a whole science behind it, but the MAOI inhibitor, basically like different ways of combining different plants that actually evokes a more psychoactive effect. So, you know, a lot of the traditions in Judaism really are based around altering your consciousness and interacting with specific types of plants. But that said, those traditions have been buried, and I don't really know the history of like why we've lost touch with that type of thing. But it is legitimate, and it's not like this far out thing. It's actually like kind of the core of what Jews were doing, you know, like before, you know, I guess while the, I don't know, it's the core of what Jews were doing. But I think it's been easier for people to sort of just go outside the religion and look to India or Hinduism or Buddhism because it's not familiar. And so they're not coming with this perspective of like, oh, well, I grew up this way, so I already know what I'm not missing out on, you know, like, I think it, a lot of it also has to do with like the self-hating Jewish dilemma, where again, if you are in, you know, being raised post-Holocaust in America, and it's not cool to be Jewish yet, or in certain communities. My dad grew up in the Valley, and he was in the Valley of Los Angeles, and he was like the only Jew in his class, and it just wasn't cool. Like, you didn't want to be Jewish. So like, why would people go inside, or like, you know, I understand why people would kind of have this internalized anti-Semitism and then be turned off to investigating their own roots.
No, yeah, definitely. And I think you hit the nail on the head, you know, in terms of that still education and, you know, it's not cool to be religious or to have that spirituality. And obviously I want to talk about more about Acacia Wood and tripping and how that coincides. But on this point, you know, we're, you know, just came out, you know, with Seth Rogen coming on and talking about, you know, his experience and his views towards Israel, and kind of backtrack a little bit and trying to clean it up and this and that and everything else. But, you know, it brings up so much, you know, we're talking about it, you know, it brings up so much about that our Jewish education has really failed us. You know, it's been cookie cuttered out. And like you said, a lot of it has to do with just the Holocaust. You know, we focus on this aspect, you know, which obviously devastating to the people, you know, to Jewish people, but maybe even one part of the Jewish people, right? And not only that, but, you know, everybody's kind of summer, you know, sleepaway camps full of this kind of education, you know, full of this, and kind of, you know, some people talk about, you know, it's kind of like traumatizing in the way that, like, you're left like an empty shell there, and you're just kind of like, okay, wow, like, that's really fucked up. And then now they're just going to stuff your head with a bunch of stuff that maybe doesn't, you know, maybe not be true, or it is true, or it just doesn't even make it relatable to our lives and, you know, nourish us in a way, instead of focusing on that spirituality. You know, you grew up in an environment where you were exposed to spirituality and you were able to handle it, right? And, you know, I think we kind of want to, you know, shelter, I guess, our kids or something from that for some reason, as opposed to allowing them, you know, you'd rather stick a phone in someone's hand than teaching them how to meditate at a young age, you know, mm-hmm. And like, what the hell is up with that? You know, so it's a big problem. I mean, do you see that there's, you know, from your experience, is there some way to mitigate that? Is there a way to, like, you know, except for you and your family and the way you choose to raise your kid, is there a way to, like, you know, create a new kind of system in terms of that education to help people to really connect with, you know, higher power, so to speak, in a deep way from a younger age, as opposed to just like Holocaust rituals?
Well, I think like Judaism needs to be defined as more than just like, you know, we can't define ourselves in relation to the Holocaust, because it means it's still controlling us, right? And like, when something is like a reference point, that point is the thing that is in control of our identities. And so, like, I guess what I want to say here is that, you know, especially growing up in sort of like a reform type situation, like very traditional and like culturally Jewish, but not particularly observant, I would say. Like, my parents are very big believers in God. Like, you could say they're very religious, but they're not observant. I think the issue is seeing like Judaism as distinct from the rest of your life, right? Like, I'm doing a Jewish thing now, and then I'm doing school, or I'm dating, or I'm, you know, all these other things where it's like, no, like, I am a Jew, and the lens that I see my life through is Jewish, because that is just what and who I am. And like, it's not like I'm doing Jewish and then I'm doing everything else. Like, Jewish is my life. It's the flavor of my life. And I think, you know, especially for kids who like went to Hebrew school once a week versus people who grew up religious, who were in a yeshiva or, you know, in a more holistic situation, it's easy to sort of divorce Judaism from everything else. And I think if you're talking about sort of like, how can we have like raise the next generation of kids to have a more integrated sense of self and identity, I think part of that is, you know, is kind of doing the education in the home and like having rituals and having quote unquote ceremonies and really like integrating the flavor of Jewish practice and Jewish thought and belief and whatever into like every single thing you do. And that doesn't mean you have to be religious, but I think it means like, you know, owning your ethnic identity rather than trying to push it away. It's funny because I feel like, especially these days, everyone's into ceremonies, right? Like, like the hippie new age, like scene, you have everyone, they're doing ayahuasca ceremony, they're appropriating ayahuasca ceremonies from South American traditions, or they're doing like sort of these like pseudo new agey, like mushroom ceremonies. And it's like, we actually have a ceremonial tradition that is legitimate and based in like text that is like thousands of years old. And you know, whether it's a ceremony around wine, like blessing the wine before you eat, or blessing the food before you eat, or whatever it is, it's actually like coming back into vogue. And people just like aren't making the connection that it's like this is our ethnicity and these are our roots. And I think if we're going to celebrate other traditions, roots, and ceremonies with plant medicine, I think we can look at our own as well.
Definitely, you know. You know, I think we look at it like a religious thing, right? But we see, like it says, you know, more so that, you know, the Jews kept Shabbat, Shabbat kept the Jews, right? And, you know, we talk about these ceremonies, right? And there is an aspect of it that we kind of like shun and we kind of just don't want to do, but there's so much depth in it, right? Like we talk about these ceremonies that go on, right? And you know, like you said, this new age thing and the, you know, it's funny, you know, never looked at it as appropriation, but it is, you know, 100%. So, but, you know, sitting down and like meditating on a nigun, you know, with like sitting around a Shabbat table and just going in deep on a nigun, like that is such a spiritual experience, such a deep place. The way that you wake up is just incredible, right? And you know, that's things that I think people just don't get exposed to. And, you know, they're just kind of, like you said, right? So, you know, here people were, you know, coming to America, you know, kind of trying to keep a low profile, trying to, you know, put their head down and not cool to be Jewish. So their kids picked up on that, right? Their kids picked up on that. And then their kids maybe were still like, okay, cool. Like I'm still Jewish. I have a strong sense of identity and I'll marry a Jewish person and everything like that. And even now, like, that's like, for what? What are you marrying a Jewish person for? Like, you know, there's no point to this. And that's a huge, it's like almost a controversial topic, right? To like, you know, want to marry another Jewish person. And that's kind of like the result now of the grandchildren, the great grandchildren of that, of those initial traumas, right? That, and you see how they've been expressed, you know, and where we are now, and how people just so disconnected with how awesome it really is, right? Like, you know, here I am, you know, I live in Tel Aviv. I know you have a history in Tel Aviv, you know, and, you know, it's the greatest thing. Shabbat to me is like the greatest thing ever, you know, it's like the best time of the week.
Oh, my, I think Shabbos is an altered state.
Oh, 100%.
And if you could, you know, everyone talks about like unplugging and going on like retreats where you turn off your phone. It's like, oh, hello. Like we have an opportunity to turn off our phone every week. And if you're American, you have like a First Amendment right to like practice that, and more people should be taking advantage of it. You know, you don't have to wear a black hat to be like, I'm keeping Shabbos and I'm not working and I'm gonna like take this day to rejuvenate. And like the concept, like Shabbat, it really, like, you know, I didn't grow up religious, but it's like I've spoken to people who said, like, who grew up more religious and say like, oh, on Shabbos, for instance, like if someone dies, like you can't be mourning, like you are really in sort of, you have to wait till after Shabbos to mourn. And I think like being able to really step into like a specific type of mental place, you know, like I think Heschel wrote about it, this palace in time, and you're just sort of in this more like elevated psychedelic zone, and Shabbat is so magical and such a gift. And another point that I wanted to make, which you brought up or sort of brought up, was that like, you know, the singing and the nigunim and like kind of getting ecstatically into like into the moment and into prayer and into singing, you know, I grew up with kirtan, like the Hindu chanting events. And I, you know, when I found myself then in Jewish situations where like a kumsitz or a fabringen where people were kind of doing that, but like in Hebrew, it was like mind blowing for me and also felt so familiar. And like, I don't really know the words to all the nagunim, but there's something about it that feels very familiar to me. And like, I think that's sort of like this like soul memory of songs that are just like kind of in, you know, like memorized by like my spiritual DNA sort of.
100%. So, yeah, I mean, these nigunim, they're, you know, they're embedded in creation, so to speak, right? In certain different ways. It's like, did we compose the nigunim or we brought them down? You know, and there's a reason for that, right? There's a reason why things feel familiar to us, right? And, you know, we talk about altered states or different planes of reality and you know, the different levels that we're vibrating on at different times, right? And I think right now, one of the things that we're dealing with, you know, talking about the disconnection is that we're very much in a very tight vibration and people live in this very tight place where there's no movement. There's no way to get a different sense of the self or altered realities unless you are, you know, taking psychedelics or anything else, you know, which obviously have value as well. But, you know, it's like, you know, these different melodies, they tap into something else. You know, Torah taps into something else. You know, Tehillim taps into something else, Psalms, you know. And, you know, I feel like we're talking about things that, you know, maybe some of the audience won't understand. But I think a lot of the audience, you know, we see that there is a strong, you know, Jewish component to cannabis, to psychedelics, you know, and, you know, say what you will, but the Jews are kind of everywhere, right? You see the Jews on the far left, you see the Jews on the far right, and we kind of are kind of pushing the envelope in all different places in that regard. So, you know, you mentioned as well, you know, talking about, you know, something that really caught me was, you know, talking about the high priest, right? The Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur going into, the Holy of Holies, right? And sitting there with the incense. And I never, obviously, like you said, this is something that's buried. You know, that's why I love exploring more and, you know, being older and being able to see this, right? But think about that. Like, you're sitting there in the Holy of Holies on the holiest day of the year, and you're telling me that, you know, there's cannabis and DMT and this is what, you know, talk about that altered state, right? So I think, you know, looking for God through psychedelics or having like, we talk about obviously like a spiritual experience in psychedelics, right? But like, how did they play in together in terms of, you know, can you be, you know, on this search for God or religious or anything else like that using psychedelics or how do they play into each other, I guess, in a more broad topic?
Yeah. I mean, I think like what psychedelic, you know, oh, okay. So let me start over. If you read Heaven and Hell, which is sort of usually attached to The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, he talks about how a lot of the temples and places of worship throughout the world have very similar features, kind of like these glittering, patterned, like, you know, sort of like how they all kind of look the same. They have some, like, they're, you know, like these, like, ornate, patterned glittering temples, basically, whether you're in South America or Asia or the Middle East or Europe or whatever. And the idea is that like all religions kind of ideally take you to the same place, which is just like connection to the world, to a higher power, the world around you. So there's, in psychedelic science, researchers have identified the a few criteria, 7 criteria for the quote unquote mystical experience. So that's a sense of oneness, a sense of sacredness, and ineffable quality, meaning words just can't describe it, deeply felt positive mood, this like sort of noetic quality of like ultimate knowing and ultimate reality. And so what they found is that through psilocybin or, you know, any other psychedelic really, the psychedelics can occasion mystical experiences that have a similar definition to what have been described by mystics from different traditions and religions throughout millennia. So there's 2 ways to put this, I guess, with that being sort of like the basis or the context, is that I've seen both a lot of people coming from like ultra orthodox traditions, kind of being less observant, but also being really psychedelically inclined. Mm. And by the same token, there's a story that Ram Dass told me, which is that he was in Jerusalem and these two Haredi boys came up to him, like totally black hat. And they're like, Ram Dass, it's you, like, because of you, because of Be Here Now, we got into acid and we got
wow.
And wow. So it's like, yeah, so it's just different ways in, different ways to the same thing, whether you're doing it, like, you know, with, like, whether you're doing it in observance of, like, of the religion or whether you're doing it sort of more agnostically. The idea here is that through, like psychedelics, I'll say, and cannabis will show you the way, but they're not the way in and of themselves, right? So you can get there on your own through prayer and through meditation and through dance and movement and yoga and whatever. Or you can do a psychedelic, and if you're lucky and have a great experience, you can kind of be shown what that thing is. It's a shortcut. But what Ram Dass kind of tried to understand better, his whole thing was like, you come up and you come down, how can I just stay up? And to stay in that space is not going to happen by tripping acid all the time. It really takes integration and a ritual and a practice. And that's why, whether it's like tefillin or meditation or what have you, finding a way to harness that and feel connected to that type of experience in your daily life, I think is really what's going to bring you closest to Hashem, or help you with that. So yeah, I guess what I'm saying is the whole point for me is like, how do I get out of my mind and into my body, and how can we all just sort of find ways to be as present and feeling connected as possible? And so it could be religious or psychedelic or both or neither.
And that's, you know, you talk about integration, right? Integrating it. I think, you know, something people have as a practice now is microdosing, right? And trying to maintain that kind of place. And there's obviously a lot of medical value to this, and, you know, just microdosing LSD, you know, and kind of being on a, you know, certain plane or whatever. But, you know, like Ram Dass was saying, you know, being able to, when you're not high, to be high, right? And being able to, I think, take the experience that we have and to not go back, you know, and for lack of a better term, I guess the matrix, you know, to not like, you know, just go back to normal. Oh, cool. You know, here I am again, you know, to like, look at the world. I think that's like one of the most difficult things is to now, like, you know, so easy because we're so socialized and there's so many, we're bombarded by stimuli constantly. Right. But like being able to see the world through different lenses, you talk about seeing the world through Jewish lenses, right. But by seeing the world through different lenses and like, you know, remembering when we're pissed off or when something doesn't go our way, or, you know, we get cut off in traffic in LA, you know, or whatever else is going on, that it's like, no, actually everything's in harmony. Everything's one, everything's connected, you know, and not needing necessarily that, you know, once a year trip to Burning Man or whatever else to like, be like, oh yeah, that's right. And then just go back to normal, you know?
Yeah. If you're getting spiritual once a year at Burning Man, you've got a lot of work to do. I'll say that.
For sure.
No, I'm not to shit on Burning Man. I've gone to Burning Man and had a great time. But I feel for people, it's like once a year you have this experience of connection, and the rest of the year you're like in your silo sitting behind your cubicle and partying like here, and it just doesn't, there's a non-integration that is very bleak. And I want to kind of see like, how do you integrate that experience into a way of life? And the thing is with psychedelics is like, they're not a magic bullet. You're gonna come up and come down, and like, unless you integrate it and you know, like incorporate it into a ritual and like a practice, then like what's the point? Because you had like a nice time and that's it. Like, what does it mean after that?
Yeah, I think it's in, you know, it can be aspect of indulgence, right? I mean, it's just another taste, right, of the smorgasbord, you know, of just something else as opposed to having intention behind it, right? You know, and there's a lot of contradictory actions and a lot of, you know, how are you going to have this experience and then go back and start mistreating people again, or, you know, cheating and all kinds of different things that people do. And, you know, whatever, we're all human beings, right? I mean, it's not linear. You know, and it's not just something that you can maintain all the time. right? But it is something that, you know, like you said, you want to bring in little by little and want to, you know, maintain in the long run. And right now, I think, you know, we're seeing a lot, obviously, I mean, Double Blind Magazine, right? I mean, amazing. And you have met, you know, co-founder in this and able to dedicate your entire life to this. And, you know, your father dedicating his life to something else, you know, I mean, in the same vein, so to speak. But, you know, a lot of it with cannabis and what people have done, you know, in terms of normal and trying to, you know, bring reform over the decades. What is it like now that we really are seeing, like, I mean, it's been around, right, since the 60s, and, you know, there's been this movement. But I think right now we're really seeing something where it's just like, you know, 10 years ago, we're talking about the push for, you know, medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. And now it's the same thing with psychedelics, right, where we're talking about the medical properties, you know, and talking about plant-based medicine and how these things incorporate and, you know, really being able to see what happens. You microdose, you know, MDMA, you know, for trauma, you know, talking about psilocybin, LSD, everything else. What's going on? You know, you have your pulse on this, obviously. So what's going on that this is coming in now, in terms of society or anything else, that we're ready for this?
Well, yeah, so there's two parts, right? So there's sort of like the scientific branch and the cultural branch. So MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, has been, was founded in the mid-80s. In the early 90s, a little bit of research started to pick up also. So MAPS currently is studying MDMA for PTSD. They're in the third and final phase of FDA-approved trials before MDMA. Yeah, exactly. It is amazing. There's research going on both in the States and Israel and other places. And the idea is that MDMA will be a prescription medication in assisted psychotherapy within a few years. Psilocybin also is being developed for depression, also in assisted psychotherapy. And these are synthetic forms of psilocybin, which is a little bit different than just like taking a whole mushroom. It's very similar to the like whole plant versus like THC isolate type of debate. So basically research has really picked up in the past couple years, but again, like Rick Strassman, who studies DMT, has been doing that since the 90s. So slowly but surely you have scientists kind of getting approval to look into this. On the other hand, things like Burning Man are becoming more mainstream, right? Like before it was the one Burning Man festival. Now it's like 70,000 people with regional burns all over the world. And and also, for instance, like Michael Pollan, who before he wrote How to Change Your Mind, he published a story in The New Yorker called The Trip Treatment, which detailed psilocybin therapy through the research going on at Johns Hopkins and NYU. And I think, you know, when The New Yorker starts to take note of what's happening, that's a really big cultural, like, validation. Around the same time, The New Yorker also published an article that was something along the lines of, like, ayahuasca is the drug of choice in the age of kale. And really what we're seeing is, a reframing of psychedelics, not as drugs that are going to get you fucked up and make you lose your mind, like how the media presented them in the time of Timothy Leary when people started to get scared. But now they're being seen as tools for wellness and growth and healing and all of that. So I think this cultural reframing in the media, coupled with, again, the progress that we're seeing at the universities and research institutions, is kind of creating a climate where people are more open to psychedelics. And then more so, cannabis has really helped to pave the way. So, you know, with cannabis becoming more mainstream and people seeing that, like, you know, something that was once like a drug is now a medicine and a multi-million dollar industry and whatever, I like to say cannabis is a gateway plant toward acceptance of other things. So that's what we're seeing now. And then just to top it off is we have grassroots organizations like Decriminalize Nature working to decriminalize psilocybin and other naturally occurring psychedelics in places like Oakland, and now dozens of cities around the U.S. are also looking to sort of do their own types of, like, replicate their own decriminalization policies.
No, it's definitely, you know, some, that's nail on the head, right? These factors that are kind of combining, and I think the science kind of opens it up. You know, we talk about, it kind of plays a part into it, right? This rejection of religion, right? In certain aspects, and obviously, you know, the focus on science, which I don't think they necessarily need to be one or the other, right? They're not mutually exclusive, but it's kind of, there is this emphasis on it, and we are seeing so much progress in that regard, you know, with research, you know, and things that are, like you said, getting ready, you know, last phases of research, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, it's kind of like pushing the envelope a little bit in a lot of ways. And, you know, for instance, you know, just in my case, right? I mean, I remember when my parents found out that not only was I selling weed, but I was, you know, I mean, smoking weed, but I was selling weed, right? It was like a shock, and it was like the end of the world, right? Probably much different than your parents' experience with you. talking about, you know, I was a little bit late to the game, right? I mean, I tried mushrooms when I was younger, you know, 18, 19, 20, and up from there. And I remember, like, the first time taking mushrooms and seeing, like, a lizard person, right, like, walking by me and whatever else. And but anyways, growing up and, you know, then kind of being more introduced, you know, with MDMA probably in the last few years and acid in the last few years, you know, and, you know, you mentioned DMT, right? And that kind of seems like the last frontier in a lot of ways, right? You know, DMT, mm-hmm. ayahuasca, these are kind of like that other place, right? Where sometimes maybe some people don't even come back. You know, I think from my experience, you know, friends who I have, you know, growing up in LA, you know, all my friends, obviously all of that stuff. And a couple friends never really came back in a lot of ways, right? I mean, paranoid schizophrenia and stuff that comes popping up afterwards, and you can't really, I guess, blame that, right? There's no causation, you know, correlations and causation. But I guess, you know, there is that fear, you know, in that sense of wanting to try that. You know, have you tried DMT?
I've done 5-MeO DMT. Mm-hmm. And I've done ayahuasca, but I haven't done, like, proper DMT. Though I did, mm-hmm. I actually did once take a hit of a DMT vape pen, but it was very light.
Mm-hmm. And what is 5-DM5, what is it?
5-MeO DMT.
5-MeO,
it's taken from a toad venom and administered through a vaporizer inhaler thing. Usually you should definitely don't do it by yourself. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to, it's not like you just come by 5-MeO. Like, it's usually, like, in that.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah. But it's a form of DMT, but it's not visual. You're kind of just, like, completely out of body. You're out of yourself. It's the most efficient medicine I've ever tried in my life. Like, you really just kind of get straight to the point of, like, what you're, it forces it out of you. You're not in yourself. You don't even know sort of what's going on. So yeah, it's weird and it's interesting. I would say I recommend it.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, what would you say to somebody who hasn't tried it? And what do you say to somebody, you know, not only somebody who's maybe scared or whatever else, but maybe, you know, we talk about the stigma that was associated with cannabis for so long, right? And you know, obviously DMT, right? Some people would say this is fucked up. You shouldn't do this shit. What do you say to somebody like that? You know,
you know, I think the problem with prohibition is that you can't have an honest conversation about, like, the benefits and drawbacks of these substances, right? Like, it really just stamps out the opportunity for harm reduction being sort of like the approach that you acknowledge what could go wrong, and then you also give advice on how to avoid those situations. And, you know, in the case you mentioned, someone who, like, did a psychedelic and then, you know, kind of triggered schizophrenia, like, people need to have that information, and it's really hard to have honest conversations uh-huh. when there's stigma attached to it. Uh-huh. You know, like, one thing I really want to get across is this concept of set and setting, right? Like, knowing, like, understanding the extent to which your environment and also your mental state going into a trip are going to impact it in a huge way. You know, like, I want set and setting to be sort of as central to the conversation as don't drink and drive is to alcohol. And so, you know, when you say, what would I tell someone? I would say, what would I tell someone who wants to do psychedelics? I would say, do your research. You know, ask people who have experience with this. Like, look up what is a proper dose. Like, you know, talk to, you know your drug dealer is one that my dad always used to say to me. Yeah. You know, like, don't do it alone. Get a trip sitter. Read Double Blind. Yeah, I would say all of that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we talked about so many things. You know, obviously, I want to talk about Double Blind. I mean, you know, it's so great, right? I mean, having a magazine, what a concept in your hand, right? And it's kind of talk about Renaissance, bring that kind of aspect back in an age where people are saying that may be dead, right? So what's the goal of Double Blind Magazine? I mean, this is obviously your life, right? What are you trying to, you know, to give over to the world in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, we say that we're using psychedelics as a jumping off point to explore mental health, spirituality, social equity, environmental justice, queer culture, all of that. So we have a print magazine that comes out twice a year. And then we also have online content that comes out several times a week. And then we also have educational courses that, you know, allow readers or audience to kind of interact with the material in a different way. So the first course that we put out was on how to grow your own mushrooms. Mm-hmm. So sort of like taking back your medicine into your own hands, like the Grow Your Own movement. Mm-hmm. And we're about to launch a course on psychedelics 101. So if you are new to psychedelics, or if you're looking to deepen your relationship with psychedelics, so people maybe who tripped at Burning Man once, or, you know, at Coachella, but they, you know, haven't really used it for like growth or spirituality or, you know, any sort of deeply intentional way. The course walks you through how to choose which psychedelic to start with, how to, like, it explains like what each one does, like how it affects your brain, what it's being used for in clinical trials, how to do preparation. So like before a trip, like setting an intention, preparing your set and setting, like what to eat that day, how much water to drink, then navigation, which is sort of during the trip. So like what music do you listen to? Like, what do you do if you have a quote unquote bad trip? Don't call it a bad trip for starters. And then integration. So like, how do you make sense of that? Like, how do you utilize the experience afterward for growth and healing and all of that? So that's sort of the gist of the course.
No, yeah. I mean, it's amazing being able to bring that, you know, I think like you said, right. Do your research. I think sometimes there's not a lot of research or not a lot of resources, I should say. And there are, right? You just need to know where to look. But it's not something that I think even when you Google, you know, research and, you know, wanting to find out more about, you know, what I'm taking right now, taking MDMA and what's the proper dosage. And, you know, what you're going to be inundated with a lot of the times is, you know, the first few pages of just, you know, anti-drug things and this, which you shouldn't do, right? You got to kind of dig a little bit, right? So, you know, it's amazing, you know, Double Blind Magazine, not just being a resource, but, you know, teaching, learning, and getting that across. Now, what's, you know, your experience and everything bringing this about, what's been like the biggest obstacle with Double Blind Magazine? Get it up and running, and now you have it running and everything across with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the biggest obstacle is like, you know, we want to do so much and we're just also such a small team and, you know, we've been bootstrapping it and like we're independent journalism. And so like really balancing, like I'm a journalist, like at my core and my heart, and I want to tell like deep, moving investigative stories that are character driven and well-researched and all of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically journalism is a dying field, right? So how can we support that type of content in a way that is sustainable, so not necessarily relying on advertisements or corporate partnerships or stuff like that, though we have, you know, we try to really anyone who wants to work with us, we try to use journalistic ethics to vet who we work with. So we also have a small e-commerce section of our site where we can support like small artisans in the plant medicine community. So we're selling like local Hawaiian kava, for instance. But yeah, I would say the struggle is like, how do you start a magazine in 2020 and survive, and also build an audience that is going to really receive it. So that's what we're doing. And it's been a huge learning curve, just being both a journalist and now also like in a managerial position in a startup.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's so tough owning a business in general, starting a business in general and having everything out there, but you know, having, you know, printing magazines and, you know, even if it's only a couple times a year still, mm-hmm. I mean, all this and, you know, I want to talk about as well about the feedback you receive. But before that, you know, you mentioned something that really caught my ear was, you know, journalism's dying, right? And, you know, we see it all around us. And, you know, I guess now I'm going to put on my tinfoil hat or whatever. But, you know, it's how much of that journalism dying, you know, plays into, you know, what people want in terms of, you know, people want this trash kind of, you know, tabloid stuff, and that this is kind of coming out more. Or that it's a business, or kind of some, you know, so people need to do things that are ratings, or kind of something that people are kind of being forced into sharing story, or, you know, telling stories maybe they don't want to tell that's part of a certain agenda or anything like that. Is what do you think kind of plays that role in journalism versus something else that I'm not mentioning?
Wait, sorry, I just want to try to figure out what's the question exactly?
Yeah, why is journalism dying? What's really the main reason behind it?
That's a really good question. I think, well, there's a lot of reasons, right? Like, people want to balance free content. There's just like so much noise on the internet and people repeating stories. Like, you know, like there's a piece of news and then you have 10 outlets covering the same fucking story. Like, it's so annoying, I think. There's also like, you know, I'll give you a more specific example, which is cannabis journalism, right? Where like a lot of cannabis publications that are dying or died already, High Times, Civilized, et cetera, they were relying on ad dollars from the cannabis industry, and the cannabis industry is not as, isn't doing as well as everyone thought it was going to do. Like the green rush bubble is definitely popping. And so I think that has an effect also on the auxiliary, fields that touch cannabis, that, you know, that don't necessarily touch the plant, but are in the cannabis industry. And so being psychedelic and psychedelic adjacent, or sorry, and cannabis adjacent, we didn't want to have the same dilemma, which is why while we do take advertisements, it's not like central to our business model. And I think, you know, whether it's cannabis journalism or any other type of journalism, relying on ads just is not working.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. And people do rely on ads, right? So much still. And like you said, everybody, you hear two extremes. I feel like everywhere you look, there's either one story, there's another story, and they're both just so extreme against each other. And there's not anybody covering anything else, you know, digging deep or anything like that. And it's kind of like, okay, look at this now, Birdie. Now look at this, you know, look at this. Now it's, now it's COVID. Now it's Black Lives Matter. Now it's back to here. Now it's the election. Now it's the VP pick. Now it's here. You know, there's so much that goes on. Everybody's just trying to keep up, you know, and, but yeah, in terms of the ads, I think it's never a good thing. I mean, you know, it's easy to lose your integrity in that regard, right? In a lot of ways, and you see
that. You also don't want to be taking money from anyone who's shady or someone you would want to do journalism on. You know, like, it straps you. Your hands are tied when, like, you have a journalistic responsibility to cover something, and then you can't because they took an advertisement out. You know, like, so I don't want that to happen to Double Blind, which is again why we're sort of looking at alternative business models.
You want to share some of those business models, or?
Well, just that our main thing right now is that we're doing educational courses.
Amazing. I mean, definitely, courses are huge, and and like you say, you know, talk about integrity. You're able to not only you know, maintain that integrity, but actually kind of further the, you know, the, be it a bigger extension, you know, of people, you know, getting excited about a certain topic and then being able to learn about it. And it's mutually beneficial, right? No one's kind of getting screwed over People want to learn, they pay, and you guys are teaching and you get paid. You know, so it's amazing. So now before we wrap up, you know, I you know, mentioned something about the green rush has popped, right? And obviously we see that in the industry, and you know, at the same time we see that numbers are up in COVID, and you know, you're talking about, you know, the shitty legalization, why the policies suck in cannabis in California and across the country as well, right? But how much of that plays into that? How much of it plays into, you know, the black market? You know, what's the real reason? You know, and then I, you know, talk to somebody who's a C-suite in cannabis, and he says, you know, it starts with people, you know, bringing their startup culture, kind of like, you know, the Silicon Valley culture into cannabis, thinking, you know, we have a big runway and we can just burn through this money, when it's not really like that, right? What do you think is the main reason why, you know, that bubbles pop, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I think, okay, so a few reasons is everyone was so excited to mainstream cannabis, right? And like, let's see how we can make the cannabis industry just like every other like corporate American industry that's based on like white dudes in suits running the show. Mm-hmm. Which is totally not in the spirit of the plant. Yeah. And I don't want to sound like such a hippie or anything, but like, it's very frustrating when you see people getting involved in the industry who don't necessarily have such a close relationship to the substance of the thing that they're trying to make money off of. But like, for instance, in the case of California, the regulations, California and other places, but I'll just use California as an example. The regulations were written in such a way that unless you're already a well capitalized, deep pocket player, you don't really have a chance at competing in the regulated industry. And so while there was a lot of excitement about legalization in 2016 and, you know, a little bit in 2017, like, it's just, it's come to the point where unless you have the money to sort of rezone your grow or your extraction lab or kind of like put the money into being compliant with regulations that are, you're going to bend over backwards trying to comply with, you don't have a chance at being part of that industry. And so as a result, California's black market is thriving, and now the, you know, people figure that out and the legal industry is not doing so hot because it kind of like shot itself in the foot. So I would like to see, and I think there is a small coalition of people right now who want to sort of redo California cannabis, legal California cannabis policy, so that people from the, it's called the traditional market now, which is the unregulated or underground market. So that people can, you know, come above ground if they want to. But I think there's also something to be said about maybe the government doesn't have to have as heavy a hand in this as the regulations seem to suggest that they do. So why, you know, it's because people are pathologizing, not just medicine, but something that could change the way you think. And God forbid that should happen freely. So here we are with like these, you know, like huge Canadian cannabis corporations and a failing situation in California, which was once leading the country in cannabis and is still leading the country in traditional market cannabis. But yeah, that's kind of what we're seeing right now. And, you know, I'd be curious. I have done a fair amount of reporting on the Israeli cannabis market and situation, not so much in the past couple of months, but I would be curious to see how that compares. And I want to also use it as sort of like allow it to provide a little bit of a foreboding tone for the psychedelic space, because I'm seeing that sort of green rush thing happening a little bit with psychedelics too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like the next thing, right? I mean, it's kind of, these people, you know, kind of moving from industry to industry because it's the next hot thing and throwing money at it and hoping that something sticks, you know, seeing in terms of crypto and seeing in terms of cannabis and now psychedelics and kind of how that moves in, right? Mm-hmm. And and Israel, obviously, you know, we're still waiting over here as well. The Knesset, there's a lot of excitement, you know, a few weeks ago, and now it's kind of stagnated a little bit, but You know, I think, you know, like you said, God forbid that people should be free a little bit, right? I think it's just an aspect of control. You know, it's an aspect of controlling populations, controlling people, controlling the way that we think, you know, subservience, consumerism, being able to take as much money out of our pockets as possible, and wanting to get their cut and not wanting to give an inch, right, in that regard. So I think that, you know, that's my two cents at least about it. But yeah, I mean, it's a tough thing to be against, right? I mean, you know, in terms of being against a power that doesn't, and you see it across the world, right? It's not just one or the other. It's not just one state or another, right? It's countries, and it's a global problem, obviously, where you have a culture of people who think differently and who want different things. And yet we're still, you know, we go up against this kind of, you know, this heavy hand, like you said, that wants to keep us, no, shut up, little baby, go back to bed. You know, you don't know what you're doing. You don't need to know about anything. You don't need to have, just keep doing it. Just be nice, play nice, you know, please, you know, and we won't play nice, but at least we won't fuck with you too much, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty shitty, but you know, it is what it is. There's gotta be, you know, talking about this psychedelic renaissance, you know, and we're talking about, you know, religion and spirituality and things coming to, you know, kind of come in the forefront and kind of bottlenecking in a certain way. I'm really, really, really hoping that there is just a mass paradigm shift, you know, that somehow gets pushed through. You know, we talk about Jewish concepts and stuff, you know, it says, make, you know, God says, make for me a pinhole, right? Just make for me a little hole to come through and I can open up the whole world. You know, so hopefully we're doing our little bit here, even just us talking or you, the work that you're doing and the work that your dad's done and everything like that. And, you know, but you standing on your own, you know, when my rabbis taught me, he said, you know, having a great lineage or parents who do a lot is great, but it's just like having a zero, right? You got to be that one in front of that zero, right? And I think you're definitely that one. You're definitely putting you're putting something amazing out there and you've been doing it for a long time. And like we started off, right, it's from your birth, right? But, you know, if we're going to talk about vibrations and reincarnation or anything else, you know, there's a reason why you're placed in the position that you're at, because you could do it for sure. So, definitely. Now, before I let you go, you know, how do you define, and, you know, we'll be closing up here in a second, but, you know, how do you define success? You know, talking about you being that one and wanting to push what you do, you know, how do you define success, whether it be professionally, personally, spiritually? In any way, what does success look like for you?
Yeah, I would say it's a balance of like being well, like physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, and balancing that with utilizing the gifts that God gave you to serve the world. So just I guess a closing anecdote to bring the whole conversation full circle. When my dad went to India, he had already like a really great law practice. He began doing criminal defense in 1967, which is a great time to start defending marijuana busts.
Yeah, definitely.
And by the early 70s, he had like done really well. And he's like, but what does it all mean? He's like, I made some money, but like, what's the point? And he went to India, you know, he had faced a lot of death in his life, like his father and his brother and you know, kind of had this existential hole. And he went to India and he spoke, you know, he was ready to just go be a hippie and like give it all up and just do the hippie thing. Mm-hmm. And he spoke to the guru Maharaji, and Maharaji's like, no, like God gave you a gift, a boon is what he called it. And it like, it's your responsibility to go back to America and use that to help other people. Like, it's not about you. It's not about your freedom being a hippie or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's about like, you know, like doing right by what you've been given. And so like, I have the same mentality, which is that I recognize like what my potential is with certain things. And I feel like a responsibility and a calling and a purpose to use it. But at the same time, also making sure that I'm like healthy in the process.
No, yeah, definitely. And you know, we definitely have to take care of ourselves, right? Especially putting yourself out there and helping to heal the world and helping to awaken the world. You know, of course, like it's a sacrifice, right? And it's something that, you know, and I love that you know, your dad decided to come back, right? Because I think that's the whole thing. It's the easy way, and we hear it all the time, right? I mean, and people go for a while and then they come back or whatever else, but it's definitely the easy way to go and, you know, to either, you know, be a monk on a mountain or to, you know, be a Baharani, a Shiva, or whatever else it is, right? It's easy to live that kind of lifestyle and to be insulated in that way. But to come out and to share those things that you know, and that's, we talk about, you know, integration, integrating that into the world as well and making a difference, because not everybody, you know, has that ability, you know, so being able to do that.
Yeah, I would say to like serve God is to serve other people, you know, just like get out of yourself. If it's not about you, then you're probably doing it right somehow.
Yeah.
Easier said than done sometimes.
For sure. Lubavitcher Rebbe, he said, somebody came and said, you know, I don't, you know, I have all these anxieties going on and I have all this stuff going on and, you know, and I don't have time for everything. I'm always stressing around you, because go serve other people, right? It's going to get you out of yourself. You know, you don't have time to think about yourself when you're serving other people, you know, and we see that also in recovery, right? People, addicts, and, you know, go serve someone else. And that's the real way to get out of that addiction. So. Amazing, Madison, you know, it's been amazing. You know, as we close, how can our listeners find out more about Double Blind Magazine, connect with you? You know, you're talking about the courses, we talk about that e-commerce thing and everything else. You know, so how can everybody be a part of that and connect with you?
So it's doubleblindmag.com, and on Instagram it's at doubleblindmag. Also, on all social media platforms, it's at Double Blind Mag. And then for me personally, I am on Instagram as Madison Margolin. Feel free to also get in touch with me via my website, madisonmargolin.com, and Facebook, and yeah.
All that will be linked in the description, and, you know, check out Double Blind Mag, obviously. Super excited for this, you know, what you've started already, and excited to really see it grow.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Thank you. Right. And good luck to you and the rest of 2020 and beyond.
Thanks. You too.
We at Calican are passionate about cannabis marketing, branding, and web design. If you're a cannabis entrepreneur and you know you need an uptick in business or an upgrade in the way your customers perceive you, come check us out at calican.com. and schedule a time to speak with us today.
Thanks for listening in to Dank Discussions, and we are so grateful for each and every one of you. We want to continue making dank content you want, so give us some feedback about the topics you want covered. Feel free to reach out to us at grow@calican.com. That's CalacanN.com. And follow us on Instagram for our latest updates.